Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love to listen to your favorite shows, hear your favorite stories, and NPR is your personal connection to the world, keep your love for public radio alive. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, and then tell the world why you're passionate about listening by tweeting or posting on Facebook with #WhyPublicRadio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Speaker Paul Ryan hopes to have enough support today to pass a stripped-down spending bill that funds the federal government for 1 month as he tries to avoid a government shutdown tomorrow night. The measure postpones decisions on hot-button legislative issues such as defense spending and immigration until next month because of disagreements between Democrats, Republicans, the House, and the Senate. NPR's congressional correspondent Susan Davis joins us now. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Jeremy.
And it was just yesterday that Republicans were celebrating the passage of tax cuts. But as of this morning, they didn't have the votes to pass this spending bill in the House. What's the latest?
You know, Speaker Paul Ryan has given a message to his Republicans essentially saying, look, guys, let's not step on our own victory. Let's not risk a shutdown and have that blow up the advantages that we had this week passing this tax bill. They want to leave on a high note. So they have some element of confidence that they're going to be able to get the votes they need to pass essentially just a punt. They're just 3 or 4 week CR, as we call it, into late January, January 19th. And it includes some short term extensions on other legislation. It's just going to push it into next year so they can all go home.
So what's in this stripped down bill?
So what it does is it keeps the government funding at current levels until January 19th. And then there's some expiring legislation or things that need more money that they're just going to give them enough to keep them running through that time period. A couple things that are really interesting to people. Children's health insurance affects up to 9 million kids in the country. There's states are in varying degrees of need right now because that program needs to be reauthorized. There's some money for that. There's some money for veterans health care. Also, the authorization for the federal government to conduct surveillance programs is part of the FISA intelligence law. Is set to expire at the end of the year. It's actually a pretty controversial issue up here for both conservatives and liberals who'd like to have a debate about that. They're just going to give it a little short-term legal authority so that program can keep running into mid-January.
What got left out of this?
There is a lot of frustration, particularly among defense hawks, that this bill doesn't do enough to give the Pentagon what it needs, particularly as you see escalating threats in North Korea and military needs of the sort of the ship accidents we've had this year. That was really what was holding it up in the end. What they've done to appease some of those defense hawks is they've tucked in a little bit more money for various programs that the Pentagon says they need. But it also helped that Defense Secretary James Mattis got in touch with Republicans and said he's okay with the short-term bill. They're really going to need to do a longer-term, more expensive funding bill next year, though, and soon.
There was some talk earlier this year that DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, would be dealt with in this bill, but it was not.
It's not. And certainly immigration activists are angry that Democrats are letting Republicans leave without a bigger DACA fight. But I will tell you that by all accounts, particularly in the Senate, there are sincere bipartisan conversations ongoing about doing a comprehensive immigration bill next year. And that's why a lot of Democrats said they weren't going to sort of hold their breath in December, because they do believe that they're going to get something. Of course, Democrats are looking at things like creating a path to legal status for the so-called Dreamers. Republicans would like some more money for border security and legal enforcement. They think that they have a compromise. So it is possible that we could see action on immigration early next year, which would be the first time in a long time that Congress has found any consensus on that issue.
Now, you spoke with the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell this morning, and you asked him about the next item on the Republican agenda, reining in spending on programs like Social Security or welfare reform. Let's listen to what he said.
I think entitlement changes to be sustained almost always have to be bipartisan. And I don't think that doing, you know, one-party-only entitlement changes is something I'm interested in doing. The House may have a different agenda. If our Democratic friends in the Senate want to join us to tackle any kind of entitlement reform, I'd be happy to take a look at it.
What did you make of that?
It was interesting because he talked extensively and kind of acknowledged that 2017 had been a hugely partisan year, from his decision to sort of blow up the Senate to confirm Neil Gorsuch, the attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, passing this tax cut without Democrats. So it was interesting to hear McConnell say that he'd like 2018 to be a year of bipartisanship. Now, there's a good reason to be skeptical that that's actually going to happen in this political climate. But he specifically pointed to immigration and things like infrastructure and saying that the rest of the things that they'd like to do in the Senate, you simply can't do it without Democratic buy-in. So that's certainly one thing that I'm interested to see if 2018 brings about maybe a little bit of a different tone on Capitol Hill.
Does he think infrastructure is going to happen next year?
Infrastructure is always the bill of the future, it seems, of the Trump administration. I will tell you that it is still remains the most bipartisan idea that the administration has put forward. Right. Economic advisor Gary Cohn just this week said he does want that to happen. And Mark Short, their legislative director, told NPR the same thing today. So it's always possible.
Sue Davis, NPR congressional correspondent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
President Trump has been urging local law enforcement agencies to do more to report cases of illegal immigration. He's citing a program called 287G. It's run by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office, or ICE. Roughly 60 law enforcement agencies in 18 states across the country have formed a partnership with ICE under the program. Four of them are in Georgia. And Sean Powers from Georgia Public Broadcasting reports the program may be expanding.
To see the effects of 287G, look no further than Dalton, Georgia, about 90 minutes from Atlanta. Dalton calls itself the carpet capital of the world for its large carpet and flooring industry, which employs thousands of people. Many of them are Mexican immigrants, like Remigio Chavarria.
I came to Dalton looking for a better opportunity for me and my family, because at the time I only had my first son. And the situation in Mexico, especially in my hometown, was very difficult with unemployment, and we decided to come here to give them a better life.
But in 2010, that life began to unravel. Chavarria was driving when his vehicle was hit by another driver.
I was trying to pass, and the person was trying to pass too. So he hit my car. He said he needed to call the police to make his report.
When the police arrived, Chavarria was arrested for not having a license. He spent a couple of days in the local jail in Whitfield County, and when an ICE hold was put on him, he was sent to Georgia's Stewart Detention Facility. That's where immigrants awaiting deportation hearings are held. Because Whitfield County, where Chavarria lives, is part of the 287G program, sheriff's deputies are trained in immigration law and can use a federal database to check immigration statuses. But ICE spokesman Brian Cox says that doesn't mean an officer's arrest power is expanded.
For a criminal violation, which has nothing to do with their immigration status, local law enforcement is only empowered to enforce state law, local law. So 287G, in very blunt terms, does not give any authority to arrest a person based on their immigration status.
I contacted the four sheriff's departments in Georgia who have had training with ICE under 287G. The only one to respond with a comment was Whitfield County Sheriff Scott Chitwood. In an email statement, he told me he joined 287G about a decade ago to cut down on crime. Chitwood declined an interview request, but he spoke to Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta earlier this year.
We had a lot of individuals that started coming into the community that was working in the carpet mills, and there became a much concern of a potential criminal element that comes with people from out of town.
Others, like the American Immigration Council and the American Civil Liberties Union, agree that 287G leads to racial profiling. ICE says it tracks arrest data in communities that are approved for 287G and looks for signs of inconsistencies in arrest data. The agency claims it hasn't seen any red flags yet. Whitfield County Sheriff Scott Chitwood says his officers don't target law-abiding citizens or law-abiding immigrants who are in the country illegally.
Realistically, if they stay under the radar, you probably could stay in this country for 100 years and never be caught. But once you violate the law and it's a jailable offense, now we can go to step 2, 3, and 4 and check in this additional database.
But even someone flagged by ICE because of 287G wouldn't necessarily be deported under the Obama administration. Immigrants who are undocumented were considered a deportation priority if they met certain criteria, like being in a gang, having a felony conviction, or several misdemeanors. Simply being arrested for a minor traffic violation wasn't necessarily grounds to be kicked out of the country. ICE spokesman Brian Cox says under the Trump administration, any person arrested who is undocumented is considered a deportation priority. He told me that includes people who were picked up under 287G years ago, but were allowed to stay in the U.S.
The only real change is that ICE officers are now looking at each specific case on its individual merits to make a determination.
And that includes older cases plus newer cases, where somebody is maybe detained as of today or detained 5, 6 years ago.
Could be, absolutely. Depending on the specific circumstances, it could apply to both.
And that worries some people with immigration violations from years ago. We met Ramihijo Chabarria at the beginning of this story. He's the machine operator at the carpet factory in Dalton, Georgia. The circumstances surrounding his traffic arrest and immigration detention in 2010 came back to haunt him this year.
Porque ya yo tuve una, I already had a supervision order, similar to probation, where you need to check with your officer. Last time I checked, they said since all my options were denied and my appeal was denied, I had to leave the country by September the 14th.
At the time I spoke to Chabarria, he was preparing to return to Mexico. A family friend says he did get sent back in September. The Trump administration says the 287G program serves the nation well. In Georgia, ICE says 4 additional counties have applied to join 287G. For Here and Now, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
The Trump administration is taking credit for battlefield victories over ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Vice President Mike Pence spoke at the White House yesterday.
ISIS is on the run. Their capital has fallen, and their so-called caliphate has crumbled.
ISIS may be on the run, but some of its soldiers are on the move, crossing into Turkey. Mike Giglio is senior national security correspondent for BuzzFeed. He's been reporting from the region and is now in Washington. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you.
U.S. officials are suggesting that most ISIS fighters died on the battlefields in Iraq and Syria. But your piece paints a quite different picture. What did you see?
No, if you can imagine the border in southern Turkey with Syria, it's 565 miles long, and it's been used throughout the war in Syria by smugglers, bringing people back and forth across. And I went down there this summer and fall and spoke to some of the smugglers, and they told me that, you know, while ISIS has been facing all these battlefield defeats, they have been able to get members out of their crumbling territory and into Turkey with surprising ease.
And what's the aim?
You know, the aim depends on each individual that comes across the border. Some of them may have just been reacting to the fact that ISIS is losing on the battlefield and defecting. Although I did speak with some smugglers who said that they were dealing with ISIS active members. And I spoke to American intelligence officers who are tracking this, and to their mind, this is helping to set the stage for ISIS's long-term survival. So while they might be losing their caliphate, they're laying the groundwork for survival in other forms.
So the assumption is those who cross the border into Turkey are laying in wait to reappear someplace else.
You know, so with my conversations with intelligence officers, I think we came to 3 different scenarios. One is, like you said, that they wait in Turkey. And I did speak to one person who actually ended up defecting ISIS. But while he was still with ISIS and he was just a low-level fighter, he told me that he heard commanders say it was all right if they wanted to go in Turkey and wait to be called back. And that's one concern. Another is that they'll go to ISIS's global affiliates, places like Libya and the Philippines. And actually, you have been seeing a rise in the amount of foreign fighters found in those places and others, so that they'll basically be strengthening these franchises now that the core in Iraq and Syria is fractured. And then the third is obviously, you know, trying to go on migrant routes to Europe.
How does this even happen? Because given that these forces, these ISIS fighters, have been cornered in certain parts of Iraq and in Syria, how do they even make it out to the smugglers to get to Turkey?
What happened is what always happens in war zones, which is if you have enough money, a lot of times you can pay your way out. And this ended up, unfortunately, often being ISIS members because they were able to extract so much money from the local populations. You know, they could pay the right smugglers to get out, and those smugglers were paying bribes to those same U.S.-backed forces, to Turkish border guards, and all along the way.
You met a couple people who have very different stories about how they got to Turkey. Tell us about these two.
Yes, you know, the first case was a young, newly married couple with their 1-year-old son. They are just civilians, and they were trapped in Raqqa. The husband had been a gym teacher, and the wife had been a music teacher. And they were both out of work for years, have really very little money, and were just basically hiding, holed up in their homes. they never left because ISIS was threatening to kill anybody who tried to escape. But as the Raqqa battle approached, it got so dangerous that they had no choice. So if you think about what they faced in getting to Turkey, it was this kind of mad dash in the middle of the night from ISIS territory, and an ISIS guard was shooting over their heads. Then they surrendered to the U.S.-backed forces. They went through a screening camp. The husband faced really intense interrogations to try to determine whether he was an ISIS member or not. And then they had to kind of migrate through this patchwork of rebel-held territory over the course of weeks. And finally, to get across the Turkish border, they went what you could consider the low-budget way. And it involved an 8-hour hike through the mountains and walking through a minefield. And they had to drug their son to make sure he wouldn't cry to alert the border guards. Mm-hmm. And so when I met them on the border, I mean, they were just really scarred from the whole ordeal. And, you know, they said, you know, we're not like ISIS. We don't have money. And to give you the flip side of that story, I spoke to a smuggler who had recently, I met with a smuggler who had recently brought the very close relative of a pretty well-known Syrian ISIS member into Turkey, who had started in the same place in Raqqa. I spoke to the smuggler, and I actually spoke to that relative by phone after arrival, and it was just such a different story. You know, the relative was picked up by a smuggler in ISIS territory, just driven by car through the ISIS checkpoint where they had arranged, I think probably through bribes, to pass, then through the checkpoint of the U.S.-backed forces, again, smoothed by paying bribes, and to the Turkish border. When I spoke to the relative, you know, this person was just relieved. They said, you know, I thought I was going to have a really hard trip because I'm linked to such a well-known ISIS person, but actually it was really easy.
Thank you, Mike Iglio, senior national correspondent for BuzzFeed. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The word diphtheria comes from the Greek word for leather or prepared hide. Diphtheria is a respiratory disease that thickens the membrane in the nose and throat like leather. The result can be suffocation, and most of the victims are children. Back in 1921, there were about 200,000 cases of diphtheria in the U.S. 15,000 people died. Those numbers dropped after vaccination became widespread later that decade. There are only rare cases in the U.S. now. But diphtheria is breaking out again in developing countries and in areas of unrest, specifically in Yemen and among the Rohingya refugees who fled Myanmar and are now in crowded camps in Bangladesh. Diphtheria is highly contagious. Earlier this month, Al Jazeera English reported on the rush to get refugees vaccinated.
There are 50 diphtheria vaccination centers like this that have been set up across the camps. More than 250 people have been trained to give the injection over the last couple of days. The government and the UN are describing this anti-diphtheria drive now as a top priority.
As for those who contract diphtheria, the only treatment dates back to the late 1800s. It's a serum developed by researchers at Mass Biologics, and it's made from the blood of horses. Only a few companies overseas make it now, relying on that 100-year-old formula, and it's in short supply. Those who get diphtheria will need treatment, and Mass Biologics is developing another diphtheria treatment, but the research has been stymied. There's not enough money to keep it going, even though early studies have shown the treatment works. The director of clinical affairs at Mass Biologics is Dr. Heidi Smith. She says the new serum is derived from humans, not horses. Equine serum can bring complications.
There is a risk of allergic reaction to horse serum when patients are given it because their bodies recognize horse products as foreign. And the number of producers of equine serum in the world overall has rapidly declined in recent years.
So the research that you're doing does not involve horse serum, but a human antibody?
Correct. A human antibody that can be made with modern manufacturing processes to ensure consistency from lot to lot and safety of the product.
If the outbreaks right now seem limited, I mean, it's a very severe disease, but they seem limited, what is the sense of urgency?
One of the concerning things about diphtheria is the fact that we've had this vaccine for many decades now, and clearly it's capable of controlling the disease. But wherever we have places where vaccination is disrupted, whether it's by natural disaster or political instability, we end up with pockets of individuals who are not vaccinated. And the disease is demonstrating again and again that when we have these disruptions in vaccination, it can easily flare. And this was probably best demonstrated by a very large outbreak in the states of the former Soviet Union in the mid-1990s, with well over 150,000 cases reported.
Have you seen diphtheria yourself in patients?
I have not. I'm fortunate to practice in a place where we have high rates of diphtheria coverage. Older practitioners who trained me told me stories of seeing cases, and just the description of the strangling angel of children is one that apparently is very apt. You can see a otherwise healthy child develop life-threatening respiratory complications in a very short period of time.
How far away are you from completing your research?
What we would need to do in order to get this medication into the clinic is to manufacture clinical grade material and start on a phase one clinical trial. So that process, once we were able to secure funding, would take about a year to a year and a half.
And how much money?
$1 to $2 million is the estimate to get through.
And that doesn't sound like a lot.
In the larger scheme of things, in terms of drug development, it's not.
Have you raised much of it yet?
No, we've raised less than half of the funds that we need to get to that stage.
So just to recap, there's a contagious disease that the world thought it licked. It has reemerged now in several countries, but a new and promising treatment that is being developed with your researchers is stuck in research. Is that a correct characterization? And if so, why is it happening?
Yeah, I would say that that's a correct characterization. And I think there are some parallels to other infectious diseases because they are diseases that can flare in outbreaks in unpredictable areas, and then you have fewer cases for a period of time. A parallel can be drawn to development of Ebola treatments. There were several treatments that had reached essentially the same stage of development and had encountered an impasse with regards to securing the funds to make clinical grade material and proceed into clinical trials. Similar in that there was not a predictable market that would attract investment from larger pharmaceutical companies. And I think the lessons learned from having those drugs stagnated at that stage of development and not at the ready when the larger outbreak occurred in 2014 was very instructive.
Dr. Heidi Smith is Director of Clinical Affairs at Mass Biologics, which is a vaccine and drug development arm of UMass Medical School, now developing a new treatment for diphtheria. Nice to speak with you.
Nice to speak with you as well.
Companies including Boeing, Wells Fargo, and Comcast have announced what they plan to do with extra money they'll save because of the Republican tax plan, which reduces the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21%. The companies say they will give bonuses to their employees. Nathan Bomey is a business reporter at USA Today. He joins us with more on this. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well, and I guess so are the employees of some of these companies today. We're hearing Comcast is going to give a one-time $1,000 bonus to employees. AT&T is doing the same. Same with Fifth Third Bank Corp. It's almost like they planned it together. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the timing is obviously not a coincidence. You know, they were ready for this and they understood that to give the president a good headline to run with after the tax bill came together was obviously, you know, plays to their publicity benefit.
Well, that's interesting. So do you think that they want something else from the White House, that they're trying to be on good terms with the president so that they can get more down the road? I mean, they're already getting a big tax cut.
I think there's no doubt. I think if you look at what happened earlier this year when the president was really harping on any company that outsourced jobs or put jobs overseas, he was upset. But if some of these companies learned that if they could highlight their American investments, then the president would back off. And I think what you're seeing here is companies are both, you know, realizing that they can get a lot of good publicity from just American consumers for doing this, but also they can, you know, stay on the president's good side and avoid a bad tweet. You know, that's what a lot of them want to do here. But we also can't diminish the fact that, you know, there are significant reasons why they might do this, and also the fact that this could actually really benefit a lot of Americans.
Well, and these bonuses are a one-time deal in the cases of the companies we've been talking about. It's a one-time bonus, not a long-term change in how they do business.
Right. I mean, a lot of these are bonuses. There are a few companies, of course, that are increasing their minimum wage, but it's hard to say whether that would have happened otherwise or not. I mean, we already seen minimum wage increases at Target and Walmart in recent months, for example. And so with Wells Fargo and Fifth Third Bank doing that here, that's not necessarily out of place for what we've seen in American business recently. But yeah, a one-time bonus isn't necessarily going to do too much for a lot of consumers. But with a lot of people, you know, living paycheck paycheck to paycheck and research showing that a lot of Americans can't come up with $500 to pay for an emergency or something, I do think it's, you know, certainly going to help some people.
Some of these companies have also announced other plans for the extra money that they'll have. What are we hearing?
Well, you know, you can't discount the fact that ultimately this is basically about corporate profits. And, you know, we're talking about better dividends and, you know, maybe share buybacks, that type of thing. You know, and again, that is sort of a mixed bag for consumers. In one sense, it doesn't help them at all because this is about padding the bottom line for some of Americans' biggest corporations. On the other hand, you know, many Americans have their retirement savings now wrapped up in 401ks. And you've certainly heard the president say, check your 401k. And
right.
Haven't you seen the stock market hit these highs? So in that sense, if the stock of, you know, Wells Fargo goes up, that actually does benefit some people. But it's very indirect, and it's hard to say how that really helps, you know, a lot of people, many of whom don't have these type of investments.
Just a few seconds left, but do you expect more companies to come out with announcements like this?
I do. I think that, you know, they'll see that there are a lot of benefits to be had from a publicity perspective, but also, you know, this is just something that can get them on the president's good side.
That's Nathan Bomey at USA Today. Nathan, thank you.
All right. Hey, thanks.
The Department of Health and Human Services is denying a report from The Washington Post that the Trump administration prohibited health officials from using seven words in budgetary documents. The list of forbidden words, which reportedly applied to several HHS divisions, includes fetus, transgender, diversity, evidence-based, and science-based. HHS said the report was a mischaracterization. Whatever the case, the tactical use or avoidance of words has a long history in America. And for a look back, we're joined by Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Hey
Jeremy.
And we're not really talking about banned words here. Explain.
We're talking about words that people avoid for strategic reasons. And I'm afraid it goes back even older than the country.
Well, it certainly goes back to the Constitution, which many people have noted doesn't have the word slavery in it. Why don't we see the word slavery there?
Well, do you like having a United States?
Yes, I do.
Well, that's why we don't have the word slavery there, because they were so divided between the pro-slavery and non-slavery that they knew that if they introduced that word into the Constitution, it could destroy the whole country.
So what did they do then?
Well, they came up with some great euphemisms. Here's my favorite. Such persons as the several states now existing shall think proper to admit. And this is not just an accidental or marginal maneuver. This is the three-fifths clause, where the foundations of the American political system and legal system are based on recognizing enslaved people as three-fifths of a person. And it's not as if people at the time didn't know what they were doing. Here's one delegate from Maryland points out that, quote, "The delegates anxiously sought to avoid the admission of expressions which might be odious in the ears of Americans, although they were willing to admit into their system those things which the expression signified." Now, there's a great circumlocution. They're willing to do things, just not talk about it. And they said, you know, later generations are going to point out the fact that just omitting this word does not mean that we really grappled with the meaning of slavery. So it came back and haunted the United States until slavery was no longer with us.
All right. Well, here's another example I want to get to, which is about something we've been talking a lot about, which is taxes in recent days. And the term progressive tax, Brian.
Yeah, that refers to progressivity in the tax. And what that means is that people who have a greater ability to pay a higher percentage of their income. It's called a graduated income tax. The income tax was passed as a constitutional amendment in 1913. And advocates for that income tax said, look, people who have benefited the most from our political economy should pay at a higher percentage than people who are just eking out a weekly wage. And that is progressivity in taxation.
And the words matter in the debate?
The words matter tremendously, Jeremy, because those who advocated for this connected progressivity with other phrases like social justice, like egalitarian system.
Yeah, Brian, but I don't hear the Republicans talking about the progressive tax system. They use different language to explain what this is doing, right?
You're very alert, Ed. The language they use now is fairness. And in fact, there have even been proposals for the fair tax, which is often equated with a flat tax. Charge everybody the same percentage, regardless of what they make.
What about the words communism and socialism? They have a lot of meaning today, but how did they get used in American politics in the past?
Well, communism had been a word throughout the 19th century, lots of communal experiments. And communism, associated with the Bolsheviks, as we came to think of it later, changed the meaning. But for a long time, as with progressive, communism was actually a benign word.
And especially during the 1930s, millions of Americans, they were intrigued by that notion. That all came to a screeching halt after World War II, with the rise of the Cold War, with the anti-communist campaign of Senator Joe McCarthy, where communist became a word that you simply couldn't use in polite company except to tar somebody with that label.
So what do you make of the fact that in 2016 we had a candidate for president who did very well, Bernie Sanders, who ran as a Democratic socialist?
I think the conditions that led many Americans to wonder whether the country was becoming too unequal in the way income was distributed that existed very much at the end of the 19th century, we're about at that same level of income inequality today. And I think it opens the door for very open use of words and concepts that, in essence, try to call a spade a spade. To go back to what Ed was saying about slavery, by the time we get to the abolitionists, they are just aching to talk about slavery. In fact, Congress kind of has to prevent them. Aren't I right about that, Ed?
Yeah, well, there's 2 million people signing petitions to Congress to abolish slavery. And Congress freaks out because they don't want to talk about it at all. So they create something called the gag rule, which basically means we're going to table this before anybody ever has a chance to talk about it. And so every year between 1836 and 1840, they had to come up with some new provision to stop anybody from even saying the word slavery.
Well, let's talk about something a little more recent. In the 1960s, the idea of affirmative action was introduced as a way to combat racial discrimination in the hiring process. Tell us about the history of the use of those words.
Affirmative action, as we understand it today, Jeremy, was actually begun by the Nixon administration, a Republican president, and it was used to address the state-sponsored discrimination against African Americans, first in employment and then later on in higher education. Affirmative action was challenged very vociferously in the courts starting in the 1970s and 1980s, and then in Congress and politically by the 1980s and 1990s. And what advocates, many advocates of affirmative action, did with that word was they retreated a little bit in order to fight another battle. They began to talk about diversity. They began to talk about the positive values associated with hanging out with people from all different races, different genders, different nationalities. And today, you find diversity being used much more than affirmative action. Here's the irony. guess what one of the banned words is in the article you cited at the beginning? It is diversity. So in many ways, the uses of these words really come full circle, and they're very subject to political use, political manipulation, and use as wedge issues.
Ed, let me just finally go back to you and ask what you think the fact that we have all these words in American history that are so sensitive and that help swing a debate one way or the other, what does that say about this country?
Well, it says that words matter and that things are remarkably plastic and pliable, that things are contested. When you have even words that are describing things that everybody knows exist, but suddenly we don't say them, it suggests that whoever can control public opinion controls the nation. And people realize if you don't have the words to talk about something, you really can't advocate for it and in some ways deny it. So I think it's not surprising that the struggle over language is one of the struggles. And we see how quickly it made it to the front page, right? Here's a conversation among some agency, and suddenly everybody is alert to the meaning of language. So it's constantly shifting around us all the time, and it's constantly contested.
That's Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a crazy busy time of year for online retailers and shippers who are scrambling to get packages delivered in time for Christmas. It also happens to be a busy time for so-called porch pirates who pilfer packages right off the front step. Anthony Giorgiani of Consumer Reports has written about package theft. Hello, Anthony.
How are you doing, Lisa?
I'm okay, because all my packages have arrived safe and intact. How much, though, is package theft on the rise?
Well, we don't know if it's really on the rise, but it is a big problem, particularly around the holidays when you get these porch pirates, you know, patrolling, following delivery trucks and stealing all those gifts that have been left at people's doors.
So aside from teaching people not to steal, how can we actually prevent pilfering?
Well, you know, one obvious thing is to ask the store, the retailer, whoever it is, to require a signature upon delivery. There are a couple of new things out there. Amazon has this Amazon Key thing where you buy a kit that includes video, a smart lock, and indoor security camera, and you can actually let the delivery person into your home. I don't know if that's a real good idea, and it can cost you a couple $100 for the kit, but they come and they tell you they're there, and you let them in, and then the door's automatically relocked. You know,
you don't even have to be there, though, right?
You don't have to be there.
Yeah.
No.
So the idea, I think, for people who worry about that is that you might get your package, but your jewelry might be gone.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not crazy about letting someone into my house, but it's an option. And another one where you don't have to let the person in your house is some companies are selling what's known as lock boxes that you buy, put them on your porch. You actually have to, you bolt them in somehow so people aren't going to walk off with the whole box. And then the delivery person can actually open the lockbox and they get the access code and they can leave the packages behind there. That seems like a pretty reasonable thing, but you can spend hundreds of dollars on these lockboxes.
And right, so you have to be able to afford them. If you don't want to buy a special box, one recommendation you make in the article is to buy a security camera if you want to invest in that. Are a lot of people doing that?
Yeah. It's becoming more popular because those cameras can – you know, the old days you're recording on tape, but now you can actually transmit whatever is being recorded to you.
And it's so satisfying to post it after you catch the person.
But there's a big thing here that you really need to think about. Many people, they want to keep the security camera hidden. But it's one thing if you capture the person, whatever the delivery is already gone. And now you got to hope that they're going to be able to find the person. And we've seen cases of that happening. But for the best results, you want the deterrent effect, and that means keep the security camera visible so that the would-be thief sees it and perhaps won't steal the package to begin with.
Right, so it doesn't happen in the first place. Okay, let's say it does happen. A package is stolen. You track it. The company says, yes, it was delivered to your doorstep, but you never got it. What do you do then?
Well, you want to check with the shipper, obviously, to make sure that it really was stolen. generally, the shipper will require the sender, not you, to actually initiate a claim if the item wasn't delivered or was intercepted somewhere along the line, like stolen off a truck. But if it's left at your front door and it disappears, some retailers, if you tell them that the thing was stolen, they'll just reship it. You really want to contact the retailer. Of course, you also want to call the police. You know, check your credit card benefits. Some cards have, you know, purchase protection if you use the card to buy the item, and you can make a claim that way. Homeowners insurance will cover it, but if you got that $500 to $1,000 deductible, unless it's a really expensive delivery, it's probably not going to help you too much. But again, that's a situation where you'll probably also need to call the police and get some kind of report. But contacting the retailer really can be a big benefit.
So who's getting hit hardest financially because of this package pirating?
If you're able to get some kind of resolution, if a package is stolen, then it may be the retailer if they send you another package. Or, again, if the credit card company is covering it, it's going to be them. It really, or your insurance company. It's going to really depend upon what type of resolution you get. You know, if the item was stolen off a truck somewhere, then the shipping company may eat the cost.
Let me pick up on that. Does it matter? I mean, do you have any advice for which shipping company you should use if you want to protect yourself from something being stolen?
No. If you're really concerned about it, require a signature or instruct the shipping company to deliver it to their local affiliate. Some shipping companies, you know, can leave things at drugstores, or they can leave it at the local FedEx facility. You can go pick it up there or have them leave it with a neighbor. Or if your job allows it, have them deliver it to your workplace.
And what do you do yourself?
Generally, I like to require a signature if something's being left. Matter of fact, I just ordered a laptop computer, and I'm going to have it actually delivered to, in this case, it is a FedEx store, and I'm going to go pick it up rather than have it left on a porch.
I think you just said that on the air, so it's a good thing you're going to pick it up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, no
man.
One knows where I am. Yeah.
Anthony Giorgiani of Consumer Reports, so nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Robin's back tomorrow. It's Here and Now.